Hello, everybody, and welcome to the final Genesis episode of Back to Basics. Hooray, we have arrived here. Oddly enough, a couple of weeks after we did our Exodus 1 live stream, but no, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. Pretend that didn't happen, and then when you're done watching this, pretend it did. Today, I still am Pastor Don, despite all efforts to the contrary, and I am joined by the magnificent, the elder and heir apparent, Courtney Fraley.
Hello.
So today, what we are going to do is something that borders on the insane, but is in keeping with how we do things. We are on episode 69. Nice.
Nice.
And this is the as I said, the last episode of Genesis. And we have still to cover Genesis chapters 48, 49, and 50. And so we talked about doing these as multiple episodes, but you know what? We've already done our Exodus live stream by the time we're recording this. And we've already set that as episode 70. So we're going to get three chapters out in one episode. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is that there's almost nothing of any real note happening in these chapters.
I mean, it looks like there's something happening
I mean,
here.
there's stuff, sure, but we're not dealing with things like, oh, and suddenly Abraham is back and he's selling everyone into sex slavery again. Like, we're not dealing with anything dramatic like that.
No huge plot twists.
Yeah, what we have here is basically the ending of The Return of the King. We've got like three or four different just endings that are just happening in succession. You know, Jacob blesses Joseph's sons. Jacob passes away. Frodo sails into the Undying Lands, and that's pretty much it. So what we're going to do is, in the interests of time and making it so Courtney doesn't have to read any more Hebrew names, I'm going to handle the reading. Hey, you got really mad at me for that one passage. That was in Exodus where it
I
turned out
got
to be
mad at
more
you
than
because
expected.
I got mad at you in the Exodus live stream because you assured me that it was not laden with Hebrew that I was going to inevitably butcher.
And what have we learned? We've learned that you and I have very different definitions of what laden with Hebrew means. So, in any case, by means of apology, I'm going to handle the reading for these three chapters. And what we're going to do is we're going to bring back our old game, the pineapple game, which no, it doesn't mean that, it means something else. But she's going to throw out the word pineapple whenever something comes up that we need to talk about. Because that is less triggering and terrifying than we need to talk. Because, you know, as someone who grew up as a cishet man, let me tell you, that is a terrifying phrase to hear at any point in your life. So we're gonna stick with pineapple, because it's fun, it's fruity, and it's oddly descriptive of our community, because it's spiky on the outside and cute and adorable and fruity on the inside. So let's take a look at Genesis chapter 48. Are you ready?
Might as well be.
Now, for those of you watching at home, I'm going to be looking a little weird because I'm multi-monitoring, so I've got this off to the side. So I promise I'm not distracted. I'm just reading the Bible, which, oddly enough, is an excuse that I have used several times in multiple contexts. Let's begin. Genesis chapter 48. Jacob blesses Joseph's sons. After this, Joseph was told, "Your father is ill." So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. When Jacob was told, "Your son Joseph has come to you," he summoned his strength and sat up in bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and he blessed me, and he said to me, 'I am going to make you fruitful and increase your numbers. I will make of you a company of peoples and will give this land to your offspring after you for a perpetual holding. Therefore, your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are now mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, just as Reuben and Simeon are. As for the offspring born to you after them, they shall be yours. They shall be recorded under the names of their brothers with regard to their inheritance. For when I came from Paddan, Rachel, alas, died in the land of Canaan on the way, while there was still some distance to go to Ephrath. And I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is, Bethlehem." When Israel saw
This
Joseph's son,
location will be important later.
epic foreshadowing. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, "Who are these?" Joseph said to his father, "They are my sons, whom God has given me here." And he said, "Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, and he could not see well. So Joseph brought them near to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. Israel said to Joseph, I did not expect to see your face, and here God has let me see your children also. Then Joseph removed them from his father's knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand towards Israel's left, and Manasseh in his left towards Israel's right, and he brought them near. But Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left on the head of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn. He blessed Joseph and said, the God before whom my ancestors Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all harm, bless the boys, and in them let my name be perpetuated in the name of my ancestors Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude on the earth. When Joseph saw that his father had laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, since this is the one who is firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall become a multitude of nations. So he blessed them saying, by you Israel will invoke blessings, saying, God make you like Ephraim and like Manasseh. So he put Ephraim ahead of Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, I am about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you again to the land of your ancestors. I now give to you one portion more than to your brothers, the portion that I took from the hand of the Amorites with my sword and with my bow. That's the end of chapter 48. Now, I'm going to pineapple myself here since we haven't tripped over anything super major yet.
I mean, it's all pretty self-explanatory. Like, I don't have questions. I'm scratching for questions.
I do want to draw attention to one thing, though. Because there is a thematic conclusion that's happening here with what exactly Jacob is doing. And let's track ourselves back half a dozen, or actually probably closer to a dozen episodes more, to the story of Jacob and Esau, the second born who usurped the firstborn's birthright.
Well, this entire book has been this brother, over and over.
But look at what's happening here narratively. What happened with Jacob and Esau was a violation. Jacob took what did not belong to him. But in his old age, like, they're repeating the themes. The eyes of Israel were dim with age and he could not see well. Like, let's be honest, blindness doesn't come to every old man, but it does sure seem to run in this family. So he's finding himself in the same position his father Isaac was in all these years ago. And you almost expect when he does this that it's going to be a mistake, or that the brothers are going to go, yeah, I got the fucking thing, yeah. And he stops it. He goes, no, I actually see enough to know what's going on. This is deliberate. He's taking what he's learned and he is applying it, which, like, for all the bad things I've had to say about our patriarchs right here, this is the shit that keeps us going. At the last moment, Israel, Jacob, he's here and he says, you know, no, this actually worked. Like, I did it the wrong way. So now we're going to do it the right way. Jacob realized by his own selfishness that he had done the right thing the wrong way. And now he's being deliberate about doing the right thing the right way. He's turning things on their table and he's using the power that he has to do it intentionally and deliberately rather than using his cunning to do it under the table. That is a really important turn in the narrative story. Will it keep? Stay tuned to our upcoming episodes on Exodus to find out. But
it's nice to see somebody have a quality character arc in this. Like, yeah, people are doing good things for God, but there's surprisingly little character growth from some of these guys.
Right. And this is something that I think is really important, because look at it in the broader sequence. Abraham not only did not have character growth, the dude kept repeating his same dumbass mistakes. Isaac comes along and his character growth is, how creatively is he going to repeat his father's mistakes?
Yeah.
Jacob comes along and the first thing he does is another big ass theological and ethical mistake. And we're all limbering up thinking, okay, here we go on this ride again. I'm kind of getting sick of this one. Can we ride a different coaster? But then Jacob breaks the cycle, at least somewhat. Like, pieces of this cycle are continuing, like the way he treated Joseph, the way he treated his other sons. Like, that's creating a whole separate bit of generational trauma. But he latched onto the one he had And he broke it in the end. He got there eventually. But he did
Genesis break it. Being about generational trauma is not what I was expecting from this book.
Right. But the thing is, it's all here. Like, and this is
there's why, a lot here.
This is why the Old Testament is important to us and why it's been so, why it's the holy text of all of our Jewish siblings. Like, everything you need is here. This is a human story, the story of humanity learning and growing along with God. That's why this is a gospel message to us as much as the New Testament is, which we will be getting to later on. Spoiler alert for some new plans we're just coming up with. There's going to be a little more New Testament in our future. Ding, ding. But here, this is the core of the gospel message begins in Genesis with the human story of fuck up and repair, and slowly getting better. Shall we move on to the next chapter?
Yeah, we might as well. I'm finding myself tremendously unnecessary in this episode, but that is okay.
Well, it's okay. I'm sure you'll find some.
Oh, this one's written like a psalm.
That's because that's what it is, Jacob. Actually, this was very common for kind of last words to be poetic in that way. And, you know, we look at the formatting of the text, we're like, oh, this looks like a psalm. Well, yeah, poetry and hymns were all kind of written in the same structural format. So whether this was poetry or sung, who knows? No, I'm not going to sing it, just in case you were wondering. And so we go on with Genesis 49, which is Jacob's last words to his sons, which were not, my sons, you bow to no man. I'm going to keep this Lord of the Rings joke going because this is really what this is. All right. Shall we?
I mean, if you can stop trying to out Lord of the Rings me, we don't need to go down that road.
You think I'm trying to out Lord of the Rings? You know, no, I'm just trying to tempt you.
Don't tempt me, Frodo.
Because if there's anything that I've ever been described as, it's hobbit-like.
Hobbits.
All right. Genesis chapter 49, Jacob's last words to his sons. Then Jacob called his sons and said, gather around that I may tell you what will happen to you in the days to come. Assemble and hear, O sons of Jacob. Listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the fruits of my vigor, excelling in rank and excelling in power. Unstable as water, you shall no longer excel because you went up onto your father's bed. Then you defiled it. You went up onto my couch.
Pineapple. Wait. What's happening here?
Okay, now I gotta remember. There was multiple.
This seems like a story that I should be recalling.
There were multiple references to Reuben doing something. I'm gonna actually have to look this up. I am unfortunately.
I mean, it sounds like banging on his dad's bed.
Well, he did a thing, and I don't have my alter translation in front of me because, you know, peek behind the scenes for all of you guys. Due to multiple sick people in my house, I've had to stay home to deal with this. Let's see. Oh, that's right. It was the thing with, yes, 29. It's chapter 29 where he nails his stepmother's maid / father's concubine / familial relationships are weird in that period. Israel never really forgot that. Here, I'll even bring that up here real quick.
Something else I noticed. I think I had like forgotten that Reuben was the firstborn.
Yeah, right?
Like, why does he just cave to the rest of the brothers? Like, like when it comes to shipping off Joseph. Isn't he like the lone dissenter who's like, I don't know about this, guys. Oh, geez.
Yeah, it's, I'm trying to figure out exactly where it is. Oh, it's Genesis 35, not 29, my bad. Genesis 29 was the introduction of Bilhah.
Googling appearances of Reuben in Genesis, aren't you?
I am going through multiple appearances. Where the hell did this happen? Because this is one of the problems with Genesis, is there's so much shit that happened, and some of it was just like one-line footnote stuff.
If somebody had their alter translation with them, this would not be a problem. Don't
give me that. There it is. It's a 35:22. Well, Israel lived in that land, Reuben lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. Like, it's literally just a throwaway line in the middle of a bunch of other stuff. I wanted to double check because, look, I'm forgetful as anybody, too. I'm like, is there, like, a whole passage on him nailing his father's servant or something that I just, like, don't forget? That seems like the sort of thing we might have done a whole episode about. Did I
miss it? But it was a throwaway line. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, like, a lot of things that turn out to be important later, it's just a throwaway line. And
Rupert was the one who was, like, kind of not sure about, you know, screwing over Joseph, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. And this is
the firstborn got overruled by all his younger brothers.
Themes coming back again and again. Like the firstborn not living up to what it means to be a firstborn, while all the other ones seize the power and do terrible things with it. And the one who actually had the righteousness to live into the title of the firstborn is the one who's the youngest. Like, I pray to God my sister never actually listens to this video, because she hears that the Bible is all about the youngest child. I'm never going to hear the end of it. So, yeah, that's pretty much all that was. So, yeah. So, Reuben, my firstborn, yada, yada, you defiled your father's bed. You went up onto my couch. Fuck you. You get nothing. Like, this is literally the one welcome at me. You get nothing. You lose. Good day, Reuben.
Yeah, I ground my boots into his couch.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I'm pretty sure there's a doesn't matter had sex meme that we could describe Reuben in this moment, but going on.
Let's pick back up at verse 5, yeah.
Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. May I never come into their council. May I not be joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men, and at their whim they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel.
Divide them in Jacob meaning what?
Okay, first off, poetic language here. Jacob and Israel are, in fact, the same person.
Yeah.
So
I knew they could both be used to refer to the person. I didn't know they could both be used to refer to the nation.
It's rare, but it happens. Like, this is the point at which that concept is transitioning. So Israel does dead name himself pretty often, but he'll get the hang of it, you know, or at least the rest of us will. So that's basically what this is he's being poetic by using both of his names and kind of establishing, by the way, the linguistic transition from Jacob / Israel as person to Jacob / Israel as nation.
Yeah.
So that's really all that's happening here. And, you know, this, of course, lays groundwork for what will eventually become the tribe of the Levites, who are that's the priest tribe. They have no land and no holdings. We're moving on again from verse 8. Judah, your brothers shall praise you, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies, and your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He crouches down, he stretches out like a lion. Like a lioness, who dares rouse him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and the obedience of the peoples is his. Binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk. You want a pineapple that?
Huh?
You want a pineapple that one?
I mean, I think we have a favorite.
Yeah, I mean, Judah, oh, you're the hot one. But also, it's...
Again, but the natural leader as well.
Yeah. And it's worth noting that Judah is from whence we get the line of kings. Like, the line of David comes out of the line of Judah. Leads.
I was smiling while we listened to this. I'm like, oh, okay. This, I mean, if you've spent any time in church, you've heard Judah, the name, as being important throughout the entire book. Not Genesis, like the Bible. To finish. Judah
One of the many dramatic names given to Jesus is the Lion of Judah. And look at what's happening here. All the description of Judah as a lion. So, like, we are establishing here the roots of thematic connections that will be carried forward in the New Testament. Yeah. All right. Zebulun shall settle at the shore of the sea. He shall be a haven for ships, and his border shall be at Sidon.
Oh, yeah, that's where you go to the Undying Lands.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so we're going to come back to that. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, so he bowed his shoulder to the burden and became a slave at forced labor. Okay, well, I guess we found our worker tribe. Sometimes happily, sometimes not. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Okay, well, now we know where the judges are coming from. Dan shall be a snake by the roadside, a viper along the path that bites at the horse's heels so that its rider falls backwards. Okay, Israel, we get it. You don't like judges. Okay, from verse 18. I wait for your salvation, O Lord. Gad shall be raided by raiders, but he shall raid at their heels. Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall provide royal delicacies. Naphtali is a doe let loose that bears lovely fawns. Joseph is a fruitful bow by a spring. His branches run over the wall. The archers fiercely attacked him. They shot at him and pressed him hard, yet his bow remained taut and his arms made agile. By the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, by the name of the shepherd, the rock of Israel, by the God of your father, who will help you, by the Almighty, who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessing of the breasts and of the womb. Now, there's some good blessings. The blessing...
Blessings of the... Hang on, Pineapple. Blessings of the deep that lies beneath?
Yeah.
Meaning?
He gave him a Leviathan. No, I don't know.
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm like, right. Did we slip into sci-fi?
To be perfectly clear, like he's doing something that, to bring back something I mentioned ages ago that y'all thought I was nuts for, to bring back the movie Noah. They did that really well with their depiction of Noah and his forebears there, the way they used very specific language to refer to the creator, that dramatic sort of language. Blessings of the deep is something that echoes the creation story and the way it's put together. And it pairs with the heavens above and the deep beneath. Like, this is literally an entrustment of all of the things to Joseph, the youngest, the most abused, and the one who rose like a phoenix from the ashes. Like, you get all the things. And that's really a way of putting that. If you want to take it more literally, hey, one of your brothers was a fisherman, so he's got all the water shit. You have lord over him for that. So yay, have fish. Squeak, squeak. Dolphins too, maybe.
All right, 26.
Well, 26. The blessings of your father are stronger than the blessings of the eternal mountains, the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph, on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf in the morning, devouring the prey, and at evening dividing the spoil. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to them when he blessed them, blessing each one of them with a suitable blessing.
I mean, some of those don't sound like blessings.
I mean, honestly, this was basically the ancient Israelite version of just like a big old call out post. Like he called his sons together and said, "Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. You're good. Fuck you." That's pretty much what it was. But that's, to be fair, in the social context of the time, that's kind of how blessings work. Like, you're getting blessing, you're getting nothing. Your blessing is that you're going to fuck over that guy. Like, it was very much a zero-sum sort of game in that way. So, finishing up the chapter, Jacob's death and burial. Then he charged them, saying to them, "I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my ancestors in the cave in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave in the field at Machpelah near Mamre, in the land of Canaan, in the field that Abraham bought from Ephron the Hittite as a burial site."
I remember that.
Oh, yeah, it was way back. There Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried. There Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried. There I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were purchased from the Hittites. When Jacob ended his charge to his son, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. There is a little bit of nuance that's important to this.
Okay.
We are establishing the motion of the people of Israel into Egypt. Spoiler alert, it doesn't go well. But Israel himself here is saying, this next sequence of the story, I'm not a part of this. Like, my part was here. My part was this section of the journey. And I bless you, or at least some of you, to go on and continue the story. But I'm not going into this land with you. Epic foreshadowing, because that's going to happen again. Like the patriarch gets them to the edge of the promised land, but doesn't quite go over with them. Like, you know, it's theological narrative edging, for lack of a better term, but that's exactly what it is you're not quite there. Yes, there's a reason why these are tagged NSFW folks. We do say a lot of stuff here.
Theological edging. All right. Do we have another chapter yet, or is that the end of Genesis?
You're going to get sick of me before the end of this. All right.
Yeah, one more, right?
Genesis chapter 50, the end of this.
All right.
All right. Then
exciting shit, folks.
Yeah. Here we go, the 50th chapter of the book of Genesis. Then Joseph threw himself on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Joseph commanded the physicians in his service to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. They spent 40 days doing this, for that is the time required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. Fun fact, since it was the Egyptians and physicians who did it, technically, Jacob's a mummy.
I was wondering, I'm like, wait a minute.
Yep, that
40 day embalming, that's a mummification, especially in that atmosphere, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't talk about that little beast, but yeah, Jacob was definitely a mummy. So
you said the area wasn't as dry at this point in history, right?
Some parts of it were, some parts of it weren't. Like, it depends on what, like, to be clear, our Genesis story has covered a lot of history. Like,
yeah,
the climate in, like, say Adam and Eve and shortly thereafter was likely very different than it was now in Joseph when we're in the kind of pre-Ramesses period now. But
I
yeah.
I mean, like, talking about like Israel down through the Sinai and into Egypt.
Yeah, we're
like that general vicinity. And I know that's already like lots of microclimates, but yeah.
No, we're pretty generally dried out as well. But again, the 40-day embalming process, doesn't matter how dry it is. Like, you're coming out of this one ready to fist fight Brendan Fraser.
No, I'm just saying that the dry environment helps stay in good condition. You can't just take a mummy out of the Egyptian desert. It will fall apart.
Right.
And not just because it's old, but because it's dry and it can't handle the moisture. Yeah.
So, like, it is worth noting that somewhere out there, probably long destroyed because they took him out of Egypt and put him in a cave somewhere, but somewhere, one of the earliest mummies was actually Israel.
Oh, I don't know one of the earliest. If they were taken 40 days to do it, they'd probably already done it a few times.
That's why I didn't say the earliest. He's among the earlier subset of...
An early mummy.
Mummification did, in fact, continue for quite some time. We're several.
Yeah, but Egyptian culture is also hilariously old.
Yeah.
Like, unfathomably old.
Yeah, we are several generations ahead of the most famous crop of mummies. So, and that is roughly within the, as I understand historically, within the middle of the kind of mummification trend in Egypt. So,
Middle Kingdom, like Valley of the Kings stuff, or
I think so.
I didn't have as strong of an Egyptian phase as a middle schooler as many children of my era.
I had to pick up some of this, obviously, in seminary, at least to cover this point. But yeah, as I recall, Jacob is on the earlier. He's on the earlier side of mummies. And now that we have spent a chunk of this episode describing where exactly Israel falls in the history of mummies, let's continue.
Oh, but that was fun. Okay, anyway, let's go on.
From verse 4. When the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph addressed the household of Pharaoh. If now I have found favor with you, please speak to Pharaoh as follows. My father made me swear an oath, he said. I am about to die in the tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan. There shall you shall bury me. Now, therefore, let me go up so that I might bury my father, then I will return. Pharaoh answered, go up and bury your father as he made you swear to do. What a nice boyfriend. So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. Very nice boyfriend. As well as all the household of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. Both chariots and charioteers went up with him. It was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they held there a very great and sorrowful lamentation, and he observed a time of mourning for his father for 7 days. When the Canaanite inhabitants of the land saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning on the part of the Egyptians. Therefore, that place was named Abel Mizraim, It is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he had instructed them. They carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field at Machpelah, the field near Mamre, which Abraham bought as a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. I'll pause for just a moment to make note of this. In our Lord of the Rings style ending tradition here, it's worth noting again, we have this kind of narrative turn because Abraham, if you recall, left his father, the polytheist, and went off into the world as a nomad to slowly gain and grow in the service of God. We have in this story raised multiple questions as to his methodology for doing so.
Yeah.
But it's worth noting that Abraham and his son Isaac, and indeed on from there, for the most part, they were the small fries of the land. Smaller fish among much, much bigger nations. And here at the end of Genesis, we have Jacob, the son of the son of the son, coming back to his father Abraham, escorted by a force that could easily be mistaken for a military movement of one of the largest nations on that section of the planet at the time. So this is like, you know, I made the joke earlier about, you know, Jacob says to his sons, you bow to no man. But this is that moment. Like, this is like a big freaking deal for the end of Israel's story here.
The grand homecoming. And you get the feeling that Jacob doesn't or wouldn't mind at all that he was going home like this after he'd died. He sort of went out and, you know, followed in his ancestors' footsteps and did a lot of massive things for his people. And then died and came home to be buried in the place purchased by his forefathers for that express purpose. It's a neat bookend. It really is.
Yeah, it really is. Like, we've said all of our crap about each and every one of these patriarchs, but it is almost cathartic to see the story end in this way for Israel to come home to his fathers in glory in that way. Yeah, he didn't go on with the story, but he came back as the fulfillment of what was promised to his father and his father before it. And that's more than most of us can hope for, honestly. It's a good ending.
Yeah.
Moving on from verse 15. Joseph forgives his brothers. Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brother said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him?" Fair question. So they approached Joseph saying, "Your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now, therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him and said, "We are here as your slaves." Foreshadowing. But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones." In this way, he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. I'm going to pause for a second here because, oh my God, text with layers of meaning. Like, first off, let's note that the brothers never really stopped being crafty little shits.
No.
Like, there is no indication that Joseph ever said this to them.
No.
Like come back.
No, to it seems pretty explicit that they're going to be like, "Oh, we're going to make sure that he forgives us, because if he doesn't, we're fucked." Yeah. You know,
he's been dead for just the right amount of time for us to use this death for political purposes. You know, and they do. And Joseph is, I would say, fairly wise in his handling of the situation, because he's like, "Look, you intended it for evil, but it all worked out." It's kind of the same way that Esau handles the forgiveness of Jacob earlier on. Like, "You intended it for bad, but all's right in the end. Like, I'm happy with where we landed. Like, with me on top." You know? There is that subtle energy to Joseph in this moment of, "Yeah, I'm good with this. Like, yeah, it sucks, but I wound up, you know, being this tall standing stock to which all you other stocks are bowing down in the end. All's good." And you can almost hear that edge to him, and particularly because we know where the story goes from here. And it, I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's sinister or intentionally like I'm a fuck with them. But that element of foreshadowing that's kind of woven in here does tell you that like there's going to be consequences for this, like for the way this was handled and continued to be handled, just as there was with Jacob and Esau, where he had the forgiveness piece. Esau laid it all on the table and Jacob said, yeah, that's all good. Good. Great. Grand. Wonderful. Run away. And so it didn't totally resolve. And that's exactly what's happening here. We're approaching reconciliation, doing that process I mentioned earlier that you rolled your eyes at, but we're not quite going over the edge. It's almost resolved, but there's just enough here for us to say, oh, it's a minor resolution. It's just enough foreshadowing to say, oh, but not quite.
I feel like human problems are very rarely completely resolved. Like they're made a lot better.
There's the lesson. I mean, that is, to make a terrible joke, the rub. Like, it never totally resolves. Like, we make it better, but we don't make it fixed. And, like, this is something the Bible is pretty clear about it, is we solve this problem, but we screw it up, and it creates a new set of problems. And the important thing throughout this entire narrative story that we will, I'm sure, be exploring for the next 50 or 60 years at the rate we're making these episodes.
Right. The entire
narrative arc boils down to that. It's not about fixing the problems. It's about constantly changing course. And I use that term deliberately because, and I'm going to draw upon Greek here for a moment, the term for to change course in Greek is called metanoia, which is better known as repent. We hate that word, but really all it means to do is change course. And that is the whole lesson of the whole Bible, is that the human condition at its best is defined by course correction, by repentance, by changing our direction back towards God, missing the mark and then changing it again. It's a waveform. It's alteration. It's never, ever fixed.
And it's because it's never done.
Yeah.
Like
the work is never finished. There's a tomb waiting by Mamre for all of us. But
damn, yo.
The best we can hope for is that we move the needle.
Yeah. This is a fitting wrap up of this chapter too, given, you know, our little experience here, because that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to move the needle a little bit.
And of course, being that that is a fitting and perfect ending, that of course means that in our Lord of the Rings tradition, there's still a handful of verses left.
Yep.
Here we go. Joseph's last days and death. So Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years.
The lifespans are getting to actual reasonable length.
Yeah, we're closing down on that. Now, again, as we've talked about many times, the argument is to be had as to whether this is literal or poetic. God only knows, until you can manage to score a TARDIS like I have, you're never going to be able to figure it out. And I'm not telling. He lived for 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation. The children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were also born on Joseph's knees. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will surely come to you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. So Joseph made the Israelites swear, saying, when God comes to you, you shall carry up my bones from here. And Joseph died, being 110 years old. He was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt.
Mummy.
Yeah. So actually, in terms of mummies yet to be discovered, Joseph of the house of Israel may be out there somewhere.
Wouldn't that be freaking cool?
Either that or he was ground up into makeup and or eaten by a Victorian. One or the other.
The guy who accidentally ate Joseph.
Right? Somewhere there's a lot. Oh my God, if you believed in like all this evangelical bloodline crap, you would have to then open yourself up to the idea that somewhere in England is a line of people who have consumed the blood of Joseph. This is why blood magic doesn't factor into Christianity, because it gets really weird if you do.
Okie dokie.
Yeah.
Now that is a truly back to basics appropriate way to end.
What are we titling this one? Mummies and Blood Magic?
No, why not? You know? Genesis chapters 48 to 50. Mummies and blood magic. Yeah, very, very fitting. So that is it. We did it. Yep, we made it.
That's it. We got all the way Genesis. Through. Yep, sure yep. enough. Forward this along to Exodus.
Yeah, and those of you who are avid followers of our program have probably already caught the Exodus live stream, but if you haven't, that is on our YouTube channel. Go watch it. It was a whole heck of a lot of fun. We had Steve on there. We had Micah from the Llama Pack and the Word in Black and Red. We had a couple of different people on there. It was great. It was honestly great. And nobody got killed and we all got out of it alive, which doesn't always happen with these podcasts. Yeah. Sometimes I am slain by my dear friends. Haha, I am making a Gen Z joke and failing at it like a good elder millennial. Anyway.
The looks I give can't actually kill. You're aware of that.
Not for lack of trying. So that's it.
You've set up certain expectations for me. I've got to try and deliver.
Indeed. Indeed. So we have reached the end.
For the fan that I assume we
yeah, the fan, singular fan that we probably have somewhere. So yeah,
so I guess this is might as well be our weekly spiel where we say, you know, if you like the show, please find someone else who might like the show and get them to watch the show or listen to it.
You can even make a drinking game out of it. Every time Pastor Don says something utterly ridiculous, take a shot and see how quickly it takes for you to die of alcohol poisoning.
You're trying to send people to heaven via the direct route.
Yeah, no. I'm very efficient at my job.
Oh. So do you have anything that you need to tell them yet at the end here, or should I go ahead and tell them the
same stuff as always? Like, we are putting out here on YouTube and in all these other places, but we are at heart a community. We have a physical community here in Japan, which is where I am, for those of you who don't yet know that. We have a physical church in the city of Kobe, the sub-city of the sub-city of Ishiya, which is in Hyogo. If you know Japan, you know where it at. You can find all that information on our website. So if you are listening and are in Japan and want to come visit, please come visit. I like to see people. I am social, and this whole internet thing does not help with that. But if you are social and are not in Japan, our community formed as a Discord server first. Like, we are a group that comes together online for fellowship, for conversation, for regular Bible studies when I'm not completely passed out from exhaustion or what have you. We have Japanese classes that happen on our server. And over the next 6 to 8 months, this is going to be expanding. We're going to be doing more stuff. These programs are going to be increasing because we are becoming a full-fledged congregational plant now. We are official in that way. This is an exciting time for us. More stuff is starting to happen. We're becoming able to do more stuff. And we want you to come join us for the doing of the stuff. So website, links to all the relevant stuff is below. If you have questions about any of that stuff, you want to know more, guess what? My email is plastered friggin' everywhere. You can find it either there or at the website. And you can just send me an email and say, yo, Pastor Don, you're a weirdo, but also am I. Please tell me how to do the thing. And I will respond with instructions, funnily enough, about how to do the thing. But if nothing else,
say, what's a prayer?
Yeah. What's a prayer? The point of a prayer is when you put your hands together and say, dear God, fucking why? That's pretty
much a lamentation, right?
Lamentation is a type of prayer, and it's a lost art in our society when we really need to be recovering with the way things are going. But of course, if none of the rest of that is something you're ready for yet, there is still that one thing you can do, that one tiny little collection of things that just makes our hearts sing. Three things, dear Courtney.
Like, share, and subscribe, please. Pretty please.
Yes, honestly, believe it or not, that helps us. The more eyes we get in front of these things, the better life is for all of us. So if you have the opportunity to do that, it would mean the world to us. But most importantly, what means the best to us is that you have yourself a wonderful week, and that you know that we are thinking about you always, and that God is with you wherever you may go. See you in Exodus. Take care, y'all.